recorded.
Well, hi, everybody. This is Dave Kruger. I'm looking forward to our collaboration in this seminar series. You may not have received the email from me. I only got the final list of who all was attending very recently. I sent an email with a reminder of the course outline, the resource guide, and the online playback at a link, and also asked a couple of questions that I welcome any responses to right now. One is, what's the most important question that you want answered during this series on stress mastery and peak performance? And secondly, for your optimum benefit, what would you most hope to take away from our collaboration during this time? Anybody want to just right off the cuff respond to either of those, the most important question about this topic or your most important takeaway? Well, as you think about it, perhaps, I welcome any emails that any of you have for discussion, anything that we don't talk about enough or clearly. I'll reserve just a bit of time at the beginning and the end of each seminar for questions, clarifications, discussion, so don't be hesitant to add or ask something then. And you have my email. Fire off any questions or clarifications that you have or answers to the questions. I mentioned in the email, because of a number of people on the line, if you'll manage the background noise, you're doing a great job now. I'll put us on lecture mode in just a moment so you don't have to worry about that, but then come on at the end again with an open mic for discussion. So anything you want to add or ask or highlight right now before we move into our first seminar? Well, I'd suggest printing the outline. It's a fairly annotated outline that I think will be helpful so you don't have to take many notes at all. And then to look at the resource guide, maybe some exercises or work tools to see if those will be helpful to you in your coaching, because that's my primary goal, is to help you really expand and develop greater expertise, understanding, and enjoyment of this area of coaching, anything that may intersect with this topic. So I'll put us on lecture mode and then come back at the end for discussion. So any questions, jot them down and we'll address them. So I'm going to be talking about some really important, that I think are important, areas of stress mastery and peak performance. There's a lot of information, so strap your seatbelt. I really prefer more of a seminar discussion, but there's so much that I want to convey to you, and I hope that the discussion can be at the beginning and the end, and any email questions or clarifications that you have. The resources and exercise document may be helpful to you, and as you saw in the announcement, this is being recorded for online playback, and the ports are on the page you were sent when you downloaded the outline. So my hope is to co-create with you in this collaboration a peak experience in itself. At the beginning and end of each seminar, feel free to add or ask anything that might be helpful and will be helpful to the group. So in our first seminar, I want to talk about stress mastery strategies and tools. And perhaps never more in our history has there been a time that there is a greater need for stress mastery and looking at ways of helping people to deal with these things. So I'll tell you a brief story, and then I'll tell you more about the story. When I was in the singles ski lift line at Steamboat Springs, about to advance to the chairlift, an instructor behind me had five little kids all about age six. She asked me if I would mind if two of them rode in the chairlift with me. Well, of course, I welcomed the opportunity, was excited about it. As we got on the chair, the little girl next to me had a somewhat awkward seating and just seemed to slump a little bit as we were riding and talking. As we got close to the end of the lift, about to get out of the chair, she said in a really timid voice, "I'm scared to get off." We still had enough space for me to tell her a story. I said, "I understand." I said, "Do you know who Laurie Hernandez is? It was just after the Summer Olympics when Laurie had won a gold in the team event, silver on the balance beam, and was really in the news a lot." And my little buddy looked at me and said, "Yeah." I asked her if she would like to know what Laurie did when she was scared about performing her gymnastics routine. And she immediately said, "Yeah." I told her that Laurie did three things. She pictured herself doing a perfect routine, a vision of exactly how she would perform. Then the instant before she began, she took a deep breath to breathe in relaxation, to breathe out any tension, and said to herself, "I got this." Well, my new little buddy seemed interested and sat a little bit more upright. We were just a few seconds from getting off the lift, and I asked her what she would say to herself if she got off, as she got off. And she said, kind of in a timid, hesitant voice, "I got this." I nudged her and I said, "Say it like you really mean it." Then, in a voice that seemed to channel all of her 6 years into someone I would not want to meet in a dark alley, she said very boldly, "I got this." As she skied out of the chair perfectly, she stopped, turned around to look at me from about 10 feet away. The same instant, we did a one-inch air fist bump, both smiled, and then she skied off with her instructor. So here's a brief overview of that. In the last few years, we've seen revolutionary changes in our knowledge of the mind and brain sciences, neuroscience, psychology, performance sciences, to apply new tools to engineer optimum performance. So I want to synthesize and integrate these frontiers to help you consistently attain peak performance mentally and physically and coach it. Neuroscientists estimate that about 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. This means that the vast majority of our responses are based on algorithms, not in conscious awareness, algorithms for behavioral, emotional, attachment patterns. This operating system ghostwrites behaviors, emotions, and patterns. The shadow story system operating on unconscious autopilot. Now, a script refers to the default mode of expectations, experiences, and responses of how we write our stories. Our expectations inform attachment and behavior patterns that result in typical, even stereotypical, responses to certain situations. As we repeat patterns, our brain wires those as the default mode. The script for each scenario in our lives operates then largely without conscious thought. For example, at a family gathering, at a board meeting, you tend to sit in the same seat each time. You look over the menu, but you probably order the same thing. Now, to deconstruct this system and the more complex system of your clients, to understand the algorithms of patterns, of attachment relationships and performance behaviors, we have to examine this default mode, the script. Change involves breaking the script. This is what you get paid very well to do with your clients, to help them break the script. We can engage in self-directed neuroplasticity, in other words, to create new behavior side by side with unlearning old automatic behavior. The approaches to changing behavior that work also consider what this does to your personal story, your identity. So think about what we're talking about in a way is to reprogram your mind software and rewire your brain. So the couple of systems, and these are proven systems to apply to stress mastery and optimal performance. Both of these are included in the outline. Now, a sidebar for those of you who have listened to me and we've collaborated before. If you want to change, focus on the system, not just the outcome. Everybody pretty much has the same goal. Winners and losers have the same goal. What we do in coaching is to focus on the system. Every coaching session is a coaching story, its own session of a map and a collaboration for the client to focus on what they want to do, and we collaboratively get to their goal. So we're going to talk about the neuroconditioning chart, a systematic way to identify specific emotional triggers and to rewire planned ideal responses for better performance. And then more broadly, a macro system to look at the roadmap system as a strategic way to deconstruct and understand personal performance to systematically write new code for mind, brain, and behavior and to perform under pressure. Now, especially the roadmap system, it's not something that you're going to actively do or engage with a client. This is not something you're going to go through in a systematic way with them. This is simply a way that we can understand more about how the mind and brain work to inform us to create a more effective coaching story and engagement with our clients. Now, a word about the limits of algorithms, which is what we're talking about here, of understanding those, from Harris County Judge Ed Emmett. Here's what he said. For Houston, Texas, 3 500-year floods in 3 years means we're either free and clear for the next 1,500 years or something needs to seriously change about our algorithms. Now, science is about patterns, the fundamental laws and principles that form the foundation of our lives and world. Our brains are pattern-seeking organs. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to the way the mind and brain work. It's not about having the answers, since most of our operating system is unconscious and not directly accessible anyhow, but having the informed framework to collaboratively ask the right question and an evidence-based system to facilitate strategic change for the best results. In other words, to create an optimum performance story or whatever your client is working on, whether that's a life story, a wellness story, a money story. When Dr. Helen Czerski was studying physics at Cambridge, she was in her grandmother's kitchen looking at textbooks and charts of quantum mechanics. Her grandmother looked at the material she was reading and said, "What can you do when you know that?" Dr. Czerski spent an expert lifetime answering her Nana's question and the unspoken follow-up question that she knew her Nana thought but didn't say as she waited for the answer. And why should I care? So we're about to answer Nana's two questions, spoken and unspoken. What can you do when you know that? Why should you care? So, let's look at several minds, two brains, and one focus, one step at a time. Several minds. A state of mind is like a software program that determines what we perceive, how we process information, and how we respond. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, what to do. Each mindset is its own software system, complete, internally consistent. Mindsets frame the ongoing process of our operating system. Mindsets include powerful beliefs that inform the stories that we write about ourselves. In fact, researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while it finds its way in the physical world. In other words, the human brain operates like a Google map, which is in a way analogous to what we do in a coaching session to ask the client what the client wants to focus on, where they want to get to, and then that establishes a collaborative framework that we can then successfully approximate the client's goal. When a new situation arises, a different map's booted up. So we all have different states of mind or mindsets for different situations. This can explain how important it is to understand the context and framing for different situations and to have a cohesive story to organize and direct that series of maps. Now, a simple example, some of you have heard me use this before. Our brains can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. It registers in exactly the same way, the same activation pattern. How we frame it determines how we proceed. How we frame it boots up a mindset that will organize everything that follows. If we frame it as anxiety and danger, then it makes sense to avoid or to not proceed. If we frame it as excitement, as challenge, as opportunity, boots up an entirely different mindset to engage it in an expanded way, in a creative way. So how we frame something from the very beginning determines the mindset we use to address it. Think about the simplest example, maybe. You ask a client what they want to focus on, and they begin by explaining a problem that they know very, very well. You may redirect that to look at what's the challenge or what's the opportunity instead of the problem. A different mindset, a different way of looking at things. So this kind, this collaborative framework of establishing a mindset and helping perhaps a client regulate. Think of another simple example. When a client calls you or logs on, and first thing they say is, man, I just had a really upsetting thing happen to me. Your first response may ideally not be to look at the detail of what that was, but simply to resonate empathically to say, you know, I hear that it was upsetting for you. Let's look at that and figure out what would be most helpful. So this collaborative resonance can help ground and center a client to be able to engage with you in a more specific and focused way. Now, we also help a client break a script. In other words, they have a default mode, a usual way of doing things, and it gets repeated, even when it doesn't work, even when it's limiting, even when it's frustrating. So a client will inevitably repeat that with you, and you may want to look at that together. This is where the collaborative framework is so important, because when the client knows that you have their best interest at heart, that you're collaborating to look at their next and best steps, they will come to know that you're not critical or pejorative or judgmental in any way, but that you want to help them frame and address something in a different way. But initially, anytime there's a perturbation of the default mode, it's uncomfortable. It breaks the script. It breaks the automatic response. So this default mode, this script, has its own continuity, and we feel comfortable when things are certain. And we repeat, even though it may not get what we want, or it may be frustrating or limiting, we still are inclined to repeat the default mode, because sometimes predictability can masquerade as effectiveness. But how we learn is when we break the script. We don't learn something new when we follow the script, even if it works. So a stimulus, such as a memory, a thought, a person, a place, can instantly shift our attention. Once we focus on that, it boots up a state of mind that then determines how we perceive and process everything that follows. Now, two important aspects in any kind of performance become how to boot up an optimum mindset and then how to develop the skills within that mindset for the best results. So to enhance capacity and performance requires deliberate practice and systematic execution for peak performance. We're going to look at both of those in detail in Seminar 3. Now, our brains rewire by focused attention on two things, possibilities and new experiences. The repetition of new experiences then encodes new learning in neural circuitry. So let's look at practical ways to do that. An application, the surface and shadow stories. The surface story is our usual logical, conscious intention and aspiration. This is what I want. These are my goals. This is what I'd like to do. Now, the shadow story, that 90 to 95% of our operating system, really ghostwrites behaviors. It may include beliefs that oppose our conscious intent, like, well, I can't really get what I want. or the system keeps me from doing what I need. Now, when the surface and shadow stories go in opposite directions, stuckness results. The surface story may be, I would like to generate more income and create wealth and sees money as security, freedom, pleasure. But the same brain can be wired to link it to the shadow story to see money as greed, evil, or selfish, and to a belief that I don't think I really have what it takes, or I don't think I want to put in all this work and then be embarrassed if I fail. So we're listening for the surface story, the conscious, logical one usually, and then we're listening for a shadow story. And a shadow story can be something as simple as a limiting belief, such as, well, I need to be confident before I can start, or I need to have more experience before I really launch this, or I need to have my website in place before I really do a sample session and offer a recommendation to someone to work with me in coaching. So we may want one thing, but consciously do something else. And inhibition is often the expression of a conflict between the surface and the shadow story, simply an attempt to avoid the discomfort of conflict. Another example. The biggest obstacle that keeps us from having what we want is the story we create about why we can't have what we want. I can't find the time. I'm not sure it would be worth it. I may not know what to do. So let's look at two brain systems, the top-down and the bottom-up system. This is for our conversation, not a conversation you're going to have with clients. We have two independent brain operating systems with competing interests, trying to balance urges with logical reasons. The most pressing conflict is not between us and the rest of the world, but between our two brain systems. We want to save for the future, yet enjoy spending money on a purchase now. We want to be healthy, and we want cheesecake with a strawberry topping, especially. The balance can be tipped very quickly and easily at times. So this is where we come in as coaches. When we write two stories simultaneously that go in opposite directions, it's not a metaphor, it's brain chemistry. One example is the reward center of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, releases a pleasure chemical, dopamine, with the anticipation of a reward, for example, a purchase. The pain center of the brain, the insula, responds when we have to part with our money to pay. So what this can do, credit card companies know this, when somebody spends using a credit card, they spend 23% more than when they have to give up money or write a check because they can pay later. It moves to abstraction and a theory. It's not the immediate pain. It's only the pleasure. So this bottom-up system runs automatically on impressions and feelings, immediate and intuitive. And this is our automatic impulses, habits. The bottom-up system can't be turned off at will. And this makes errors of intuition and emotional origin difficult to prevent, which is, I think, why we need as coaches to understand this and helping someone revise their operating system. Now, the top-down, system two, is conscious, logical. It's the seat of self-control, executive functioning, and reasoning. This top-down system determines voluntary attention and choice, the deliberation of decision-making. So when this bottom-up system prevails, decisions shift toward impulsivity. So whenever anyone is on tilt emotionally, they may overspend, overborrow, overeat, or any other habits without conscious regulation or direction. So an awareness of the factors which lower our threshold to resilience against impulsivity becomes essential to recognize. So, willpower can be influenced by a number of variables that can deplete it. Stress, sustained mental effort, even low glucose. To Nana's question, why should you care? This is all crucial for deliberate practice, for skill development, and for optimum performance. So let's move now to one focus. Here's an example of that. Several minds, two brains, and now one focus. We're narrowing this down, okay? A pro tennis player was having an outstanding season in her very outstanding career. We met just before she left for Wimbledon, where she was one of the three top seeds. She was having difficulty with her serve. Her usual powerful, flawless serve was strained. I asked her to take us in detail, frame by frame, in her mind, her usual pattern of serve, frame by frame, then to describe or notice with me what might be different as a second step. When she got to the point of tossing the ball in the air, she had an instantaneous flash of her coach looking at her critically. This literal nanosecond of moving from the flow state of motor memory of the procedural process that had become automatic and world-class disrupted that well-grooved pattern. When she instantaneously and almost perceptibly moved from the total reliance on her bottom-up system one of automatic superb practice performance, it had been well-grooved from thousands, tens of thousands of hours of practice. When she moved to her top-down system two, to think about even for a second what she was doing, she hit the ball slightly differently. At this level of play, it meant everything. Let's apply that to coaching. Here's, I think, a practical metaphor. See if this has meaning to you. Most of you probably understand or have done a mindfulness meditation where you focus, where you get in a relaxed position, just focus only on your breath. You breathe in, relaxation, breathe out any tension. If you have a thought, you let it go. You don't engage it and refocus on your breath. That's exactly what you can do in working with a client to get grounded and centered before you have the initial contact with that client and are attuned to the client's experience, the client's story. If you have the equivalent of a thought when you're doing this, it may be, well, am I asking the right question? Or I wonder, you know, or should I share this experience? Refocus on the client to develop the client's story from the client's point of reference and the full thinking, feeling, and experiencing point of view of the client and to develop that optimally. So the power is in the focus. Our unconscious minds do not distinguish positive versus negative. It doesn't recognize future versus past, but only focuses on here and now. This is the power of selective attention. The brain works like a camera. Out of all possibilities, what you choose to focus on determines the awareness and aligns the energy field of your brain for attention. Attention holds the key to choice architecture, which is our specialty in coaching, to look at the choice this moment. It serves to regulate emotion and the state of mind that we choose for a task. Successful performance execution of whatever type, mental, physical, depends on directing and sustaining focus to a specific choice and ignoring others. Here's a simple application. My wife gifted both of us with enrollment in the BMW Racing School for 3 days in Greenville, South Carolina, for an anniversary. It was a fascinating and masterful application of performance sciences. We went through various aspects of driving challenges with pro racers. One of the first basics they taught us was how to navigate sharp turns and curves at high speed. Since our brains follow our eyes, when we look at where we want to go, we create a successful turn even under pressure. If we look at the obstacle we want to avoid, our brain follows our eyes too, and we get what we focus on. So the first thing they said in this regard was, look at where you want to go, not what you want to avoid. If you focus on avoiding the obstacle, you are most likely to hit it. This is an example of focus that we do with our clients and help them develop that focus and then come to see and understand how they can develop that model more and more. And the simple coaching model, a story each session with a client, they focus on what they want to address, where they want to get to with that, and we help them successively approximate it. And with this map and focus, it can help measure progress along the way. It can help tell what's detour and distraction. So let's say an athletic coach who focuses on what not to do with players, it becomes a prelude to a choke. Like the pro tennis player, thinking just even a nanosecond about her coach and being critical, that was a choke. Any change or disruption, even for a second, in performance flow in sports is a choke. We can learn a great deal from this, because any disruption in your focus with clients can be analogous to a choke if you're kind of wondering, you know, if you should ask something, or if you get distracted in some other than the point of reference of the client's story. So this is applicable for anyone getting analytical or self-critical. It can disrupt this bottom-up system, this natural flow, to move outside the zone to become an observer. So this most fundamental principle is one we know quite well from neuroscience and quantum physics. You get what you focus on, not what you want. So look where you want to go, from the next curve to 20 years from now. Michael Phelps, the most decorated Olympian with 22 medals, including 18 golds, described his significance of focus. When I'm focused, there is not one single thing, person, anything that can stand in my way of doing something. If I want something bad enough, I'm going to get there. So new neuronal pathways and networks are created when you focus on solutions. But the already existing circuitry becomes further etched when you focus on existing problems, even if you try to solve them. This is why people can get stuck in therapy or in simply seeing and repeating in animated way problems, sort of like regular patio meetings of the Ain't It Awful Club. This concept offers explanation at a brain level for why a solution focus is more effective than a problem focus. The brain connections literally become mind maps and subsequently influence the reality that we see. We create brain pathways and connections by what we focus on. We choose what we pay attention to. What we can't control, we can determine not to focus on it, to let it go, to redirect our energy, focus, and attention to what we can determine. A simple example is that rather than focusing on obstacles that hold us back, we refocus on things that can move us forward and the positive connections. So here's a summary of a three-step process to specifically counter negative thoughts or negative self-talk or anything else in that time capsule that you're probably all too familiar with. Negative self-talk, negative thoughts, looking at problems. Recognize the error message from your brain, that your brain is repeating a warning that says you can't do it. You know, you don't have the whatever. Recognize an error message from your brain. Reframe it to look at possibility instead of problem. And then refocus on the next step, on the system that you create to address it in a positive way. This is self-directed neuroplasticity. So what this means, basically, back to Nana, is don't believe everything you think. So let's look at ways to regulate states of mind and manage emotions. A state of mind is a particular set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. A key element of mastery is to become aware of various states of mind and a particular focus on what state works best for what purpose. So the challenge is to regulate states of mind, especially when there are various emotional triggers in charged situations. It is the most important variable to determine successful performance of any type, athletic, intellectual, executive, relational. The state of mind determines the meaning you attach, and the meaning determines behavior. So by changing the state of mind, you change the behavior. So here's what we know. A gap in performance, in whatever area, a gap in performance has more to do with mindset than with motivation and intelligence. When a performer in any endeavor, athlete, surgeon, executive, has practiced essentially the same thousands and thousands of hours as the next person, optimum outcome is determined by more specific mental state for optimum performance. So here are some things that can lower the thresholds to emotional triggers that dispose us at times to compromised performance. Preset meanings, like certain biases, emotional triggers, depleted energy, distraction, emotional overwhelm. Too many choices can even be challenging because it challenges the cognitive reserves to keep these choices in mind and then maybe feel overwhelmed. Significant emotional charge of specific emotional triggers that can instantly boot up a mindset, a state change that will usually activate the kind of things in that time capsule, the negative self-talk, the belief that you can't do it. And I call it a time capsule because think about all the things that instantly happen in your head when there's an emotional trigger. That probably has not changed since you were roughly about 5 or 6 years old. I'll give a case example of how that can be applied in just a bit. So here's an example of how an influence of even slightly depleted energy can cause people to fall back to an earlier default mode of thinking and deciding. This is a study reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. 8 parole judges were studied for 3 years for their decision-making regarding applications granted for parole. The average rate of granting parole, 35%. Now, the exact time their decisions were made was studied in relation, among other things, to their three food breaks, morning, lunch, and afternoon. After each meal, 65% of the requests were granted. Just before noon, just before the end of the day, when blood glucose was lowest, the approval rate dropped to almost 0%. At those times of low blood glucose and greater fatigue, they resorted to more critical and judgmental thinking. Now, this is something that we can come back to, and I have other examples of how to look at applications in working with clients. So, one thing I want to mention in the overview is to look at the neural wiring for emotional triggers. Now, the neural conditioning chart is in the exercise section in the outline, page 14, I think. We'll address self-regulation in a more systematic way. And to illustrate this, I want to tell you a little bit about how I developed it in a case illustration. I was working with an executive who was doing some terrific work, and she mentioned just before the Thanksgiving holidays with her family, she said, "Dave, can we work on something? I want to work on something personal. I have a terrible time with my family on holidays, and I like to work on that." I said, "Sure, whatever would be helpful." Her family had one major holiday each year that they all got together, her mom, dad, sister, brothers, and her, and this year it was on a Thanksgiving. She said, "I resolved that I am not going to lose it and get in arguments and struggles with them, and I can last almost an entire day, but then something happens that it just triggers, and I'm off to the races, and it's the same kind of disaster it always is." And I asked her to give me an example of what would trigger her getting into that reactive state. And she said, "Well, it's a certain look from my dad, a certain way that my sister would taunt me, my brother." I said, "Consider doing this. Consider scheduling an appointment with yourself, maybe 30, 45 minutes, and write down," and this is your neural conditioning chart that you have in the resources, and this was the very beginning of this. I asked her to write down, without getting triggered, the specific trigger for each of these emotional responses, and she listed, she later listed a bunch of these. And I emphasized not to get triggered, but to be just objective, like a fly on the wall. And she would notice several things that she did. And then in a second column, I asked her to do two columns. The second column, write down for each trigger what her usual emotional response was, or her usual behavior, without getting triggered, because there was a trigger and then a response, and ask her to observe that. And then a second time, maybe a day or two later, to again schedule a time with herself to work on a cue of focus of physiology, a cue, something that she could do that would focus her getting grounded and centered. She chose to touch her ring, and she chose a focus phrase of relaxed and powerful, and at the same time, she did a deep breath to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension. So this was 3 or 4 seconds. She touched the ring, had the focus phrase, did the deep breath. And then that's the third column. And the fourth column is her ideal response. And I asked her to consider this second time, the second session with herself, to write down the ideal response to each of these triggers, what she ideally would like to do or say after she stayed grounded and centered, and to write down the ideal behavior for every one of the triggers. And I emphasized to practice this mantra, the cue, the focus, the physiology, and it was something she could do while she was sitting at the table, but I emphasized that there may be times she may need to get up, maybe take a walk, go to the bathroom, that there were going to be some triggers, especially while this was new, that she needed to address and to do whatever it took to not fall into that time capsule. The first thing I asked her, I forgot to mention this to you, when she described these behaviors and what she would do and how she would feel, I asked her, what's the age of that conversation? She knew immediately what I meant. She said, I'm 13 all over again. I'm in the same fights and the same kind of stuff that was happening when I was 13 and at home. So that's where the cue, the focus, the physiology, and the ideal behavior. So she practiced this before she, and I was really eager to hear, as she came back after Thanksgiving, she said, the best holiday I ever had. I at times needed to get up, to walk away, to go to the bathroom, but I was able to regulate better than I ever have before. And I've heard from her since, and even with a subsequent holiday, she's got it down now. And she is relating in a very different way with her family. So this is simply a way to help someone develop a systematic way to self-regulate and to engage then an optimum mindset for whatever that she wants to do. So these four columns, try it yourself. Write down two or three emotional triggers that you have, one at a time. Write down probably the biggest emotional trigger that you have. And then look at a couple of other things that are dead certain to set you off. And then look at what your behavior or your feeling is during those triggers without triggering yourself. Then come back to it. Use the neural conditioning chart. Come back to it. Look at column three to develop a mantra, to develop a way to get grounded and centered, to then engage an ideal behavior. Here's another example of that and an application. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free shot percentage, lowest in their division. There were 217 out of 217 teams. So during practice, Reed immediately had his players, when they shot a free shot, develop a mantra before each free shot. Two dribbles, the cue. He suggested a focus phrase, but for them to develop their own, such as relaxed and smooth. While they were doing a deep breath, the physiology to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. So it took only two dribbles. The dribble booted up the focus and the physiology, and they would do this before each free shot. Now, additionally, they didn't just practice free throws like this, because in a game, you don't get to shoot 30 free throws and count your best. He would blow a whistle suddenly during practice, had them go to the free shot line, shoot two free throws using this system. If they made them both, they got a break. If they didn't, they ran four laps. Because this is the tilt situation of somebody in a game. They're just fouled. They may be in pain. They're upset. And they go to the free shot line. So they need to immediately get grounded and centered. After 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. So the idea of column four is for each emotional trigger to have a pre-planned ideal response, including behavior. Now, this pre-planning simplifies the process that you can move immediately into an ideal behavior when it's pre-planned. You don't have to think about it, rather than having to figure it out on the fly. So these four steps will result in neural conditioning. It will rewire your brain. Once you do it, go across all four columns, the usual cue, recognize the response, to be aware of it, not to get into it, but to develop more observation and awareness of it, to not be stuck in this state chain. That little thin line between column one and column two is a state change. The emotional trigger creates a state change. And everything in column two, all the behaviors, the feelings, are not the cause of what follows. They're the result of the state change. So column three is to reinstate the state of mind to engage in optimum behavior, a way of thinking, column four. So column one and two, the emotional trigger and usual response, to recognize quickly the trigger and the state change, to cue your radar to recognize this and not get stuck in this content of the altered state. And like a time capsule, the content in that column two will never change. My client recognized that everything she experienced after she got set off with her family, it was no different, same word, same feeling when she was 13 and since, including major holidays. So like a time capsule, the content will never change. You can't think, reason, feel, figure, or therapize your way out of a state of mind. This is a way of effectively addressing it, much more than other approaches, even therapy. You can understand why, but that doesn't address change. You may know this if you've tried to figure out what I'm up to. After 25 years of practicing psychiatry, psychoanalysis, teaching, I made a transition to mentor coaching. And this process was so important because in therapy, I could only help someone come to the end of the past. I couldn't really help them develop a new story. This, what you're doing, what we're doing now, is about how to facilitate, how to be a catalyst for the client to develop a new story. So as you do this neural conditioning across horizontally, you'll notice two things. As you repeat your mantra, the cue, the focus phrase, the physiology, like deep breathing, you'll notice that ultimately, over time, the cue alone will be sufficient to induce that deep, grounded, centered state. You won't have to do the focus phrase and the physiology each time. This is the first phase of neural conditioning. You've rewired your brain to use an automatic cue to induce a state of mind. And as you move through all four steps to engage an ideal response, when you repeat this enough, it'll rewire your brain. Ultimately, the initial emotional trigger will automatically couple then with a balanced state of mind and the ideal response. The trigger won't be triggering, but a cue for an ideal behavior, for the default behavior. So this is the hard work miracle. Your brain has rewired its operating system. And finally, elite performers in business, sports, and the arts know and live the wisdom that the more enjoyable the experience, the better the performance will be. My favorite grandmother said it very simply. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So in our next seminar, we're going to talk about the neuroscience of peak performance and address things like confidence, mindfulness, deliberate practice, and unlearning. I'm going to move us, we don't have as much time as I thought, we've got a couple of minutes, I'm going to move us to discussion mode. If there are any questions, clarifications, I welcome. One second. We're in discussion mode now, if you'll manage the background noise. And any questions or thoughts from anyone? May I ask you to manage the background noise, please? Any questions or things you'd like us to talk about? If there are none right now, feel free to email me. You have my email. I'll be eager to address any thoughts or questions you have. And if you think about both of those questions, if you have responses to that, I promise to look at those and to work them into our discussion in our subsequent seminars. So thank you all very much. I look forward to hearing from you. Again, any thoughts or input, feel free to fire off an email. I look forward to picking up with you right here next time. See you guys. Bye now.